logging into pumps and relays remotely to shut them on or off, see their diagnostics, all of that. Once the light on the drive winked on, she navigated it to her screen. Inside, she found a host of folders and files. The little drive must have been stuffed to the brim with them. She wondered if Scotty had gotten any sleep at all the night before. At the top of the list of primary folders was a file named Jules. She clicked this one, and up popped a short text file, obviously from Scotty, but noticeably unsigned.
Jay, don't get caught with this, okay? This is everything from Mr. Lawman's computers, work, and home, the last 5 years. A ton of stuff, but wasn't sure what you needed, and this was easier to automate. Keep the ties. I got plenty. And I took a cookie. Hope you don't mind.
Juliet smiled. She felt like reaching out and brushing her fingers across the words, but it wasn't paper and wouldn't be the same. She closed the note and deleted it, then cleared out her trash. Even the first letter of her name up there felt like too much information. She leaned away from her desk and peered into the cafeteria, which appeared dark and empty. It was not yet 5 in the morning, and she would have the upper floor to herself for a while. She first took a moment to browse through the directory structure to see what kind of data she was dealing with. Each folder was neatly labeled. It appeared she had an operating history of Holston's 2 computers. Every keystroke, every day, going back a little more than 5 years, all organized by date and time. Juliet felt overwhelmed by the sheer amount of information. It was far more than she could hope to weed through in a lifetime. But at least she had it. The answers she needed were in there, somewhere among all those files. And somehow, it felt better. She felt better. Just knowing that the solution to this riddle, to Holston's decision to go to cleaning, could now fit in the palm of her hand. She was several hours into sifting through the data when the cafeteria crew staggered in to clean up last night's mess and prepare for breakfast. One of the most difficult things to get used to about the up top was the exacting schedule everyone kept. There was no third shift. There was barely a second shift, except for the dinner staff. In the down deep, the machines didn't sleep, and so the workers barely did either. Work crews often stayed on into extra shifts, and so Juliet had gotten used to surviving on a handful of hours of rest a night. The trick was to pass out now and then from sheer exhaustion, to just rest against a wall with one's eyes closed for 15 minutes, long enough to hold the tiredness at bay. But what had once been survival was now luxury. The ability to forego sleep gave her time in the morning and at night to herself. Time to invest in frivolous pursuits on top of the cases she was supposed to be working. It also gave her the opportunity to teach herself how to do the blasted job, since Marnes had become too depressed to help her get up to speed.
Marnes. She looked at the clock over his desk. It was 8:10, and the vats of warm oatmeal and corn grits were already filling the cafeteria with the smells of breakfast.
Marnes was late. She'd been around him less than a week, but she had yet to see him late to anything, ever. This break in the routine was like a timing belt stretching out of shape, a piston developing a knock. Juliet turned her monitor off and pushed away from her desk. Outside, first shift breakfast was beginning to file in, food tokens clinking in the large bucket by the old turnstiles. She left her office and passed through the traffic, spilling from the stairwell. In the line, a young girl tugged on her mother's coveralls and pointed to Juliet as she passed. Juliet heard the mother scolding her child for being rude. There had been quite a bit of chatter the past few days over her appointment. This woman, who had disappeared into mechanical as a child and who had suddenly re-emerged to take over for one of the more popular sheriffs in memory. Juliet cringed from the attention and hurried into the stairwell. She wound her way down the steps as fast as a lightly loaded porter, her feet bouncing off each tread, faster and faster in what felt like an unsafe pace. 4 flights down, after squeezing around a slow couple in between a family heading upstairs for breakfast, she hit the apartment landing, just below her own, and passed through the double doors. The hallway beyond was busy with morning sights and sounds. A squealing teapot, the shrill voices of children, the thunder of feet overhead, shadows hurrying to meet their casters before trailing them off to work. Younger children were lumbering reluctantly off to school. Husbands and wives kissed in doorways while toddlers tugged at their coveralls and dropped toys in plastic cups. Juliet took several turns, winding through the hallways and around the central staircase to the other side of the level. The deputy's apartment was on the far side, way in the back. She surmised that Marnes had qualified for several upgrades over the years, but had passed on them. The one time she had asked Alice, Mayor Jean's old secretary, about Marnes, she had shrugged and told Juliet that he had never wanted or expected anything more than second fiddle. Juliet assumed she meant that he never wanted to be sheriff, but she had begun to wonder in how many other areas of his life that philosophy applied. As she reached his hall, two kids ran by holding hands, late for school. They giggled and squealed around the corner, leaving Juliet alone in the hallway. She wondered what she would say to Marnes to justify coming down, to explain her worry. Maybe now was a good time to ask for the folder that he couldn't seem to be without. She could tell him to take the day off, let her handle the office while he got some rest, or maybe fib a little and say she was already in the area for a case. She stopped outside his door and lifted her hand to knock. Hopefully he wouldn't see this as her projecting authority, right? She was just concerned for him, that was all. She rapped on the steel door and waited for him to call her inside. And maybe he did. His voice over the last few days had eroded into a dull and thin rasp. She knocked again, louder this time. "Deputy?" she called. "Everything okay in there?" A woman popped her head out of a door down the hallway. Juliet recognized her from the school recess time in the cafeteria. Was pretty sure her name was Gloria.
"Hey, Sheriff."
"Hey, Gloria, you haven't seen Deputy Marnes this morning, have you?" She shook her head, placed a metal rod in her mouth, and started wrapping her long locks into a bun.
"I haven't," she mumbled.
She shrugged her shoulders and jabbed the rod through her bun, locking her hair into place. "He was on the landing last night, looking ass-whipped as ever." She frowned. "He not show up for work?" Juliet turned back to the door and tried the handle. It clicked open with the feel of a well-maintained lock. She pushed the door in.
"Deputy! It's Jules! Just checking in on ya."
The door swung open into darkness. The only light spilling in was from the hallway, but it was enough. Juliet turned to Gloria.
"Call Doc Hicks. No, shit." She was still thinking down deep. "Who's the closest doctor up here? Call him."
She ran into the room, not waiting for a reply. There wasn't much space to hang oneself in the small apartment, but Marnes had figured out how. His belt was cinched around his neck, the buckle lodged into the top of the bathroom door. His feet were on the bed, but at a right angle, not enough to support his weight. His butt drooped below his feet, his face no longer red, the belt biting deep into his neck. Juliet hugged Marnes's waist and lifted him up. He was heavier than he looked. She kicked his feet off the bed and they flopped to the floor, making it easier to hold him. There was a curse at the door. Gloria's husband ran in and helped Juliet support the deputy's weight. The both of them fumbled for the belt, trying to dislodge it from the door. Juliet finally tugged the door open, freeing him.
"On the bed," she huffed.
They lifted him to the bed and laid him out flat. Gloria's husband rested his hands on his knees and took deep breaths.
"Gloria ran for Dr. O'Neill."
Juliet nodded and loosened the belt from around Marnes's neck. The flesh was purple beneath it. She felt for a pulse, remembering Roger looking just like this when she'd found him down in mechanical, completely still and unresponsive. It took her a moment to be sure that she was looking at the second dead body she had ever seen. And then she wondered, as she sat back, sweating, waiting for the doctor to arrive, whether this job she had taken would ensure it wasn't the last. 5. After filling out reports, discovering Marnes had no next of kin, speaking with the coroner at the dirt farm, and answering questions from nosy neighbors, Juliet finally took a long and lonely walk up 8 flights of stairs, back to her empty office. She spent the rest of the day getting little work done, the door to the cafeteria open, the small room much too crowded with ghosts. She tried repeatedly to lose herself in the files from Holston's computers, but Marnes's absence was incredibly sadder than his moping presence had been. She couldn't believe he was gone. It almost felt like an affront to bring her here and then leave her so suddenly. And she knew this was a horrible and selfish thing to feel, and even worse to admit. As her mind roamed, she glanced occasionally out the door, watching the clouds slide across the distant wall screen. She debated with herself on whether they appeared light or dense, if tonight would be a good one for viewing stars. It was another guilt-ridden thought, but she felt powerfully alone, a woman who prided herself on needing no one. She played some more with the maze of files while the light of an unseen sun diminished in the cafeteria, while 2 shifts of lunch and 2 shifts of dinner vibrated and then subsided around her, all the while watching the roiling sky and hoping, for no real logical reason, for another chance encounter with the strange star hunter from the night before. And even sitting there, with the sounds and scents of everyone on the upper 48 eating, Juliet forgot to. It wasn't until the second shift staff was leaving, the lights cut down to quarter power, that Pam came in with a bowl of soup and a biscuit. Juliet thanked her and reached into her coveralls for a few chits, but Pam refused. The young woman's eyes, red from crying, drifted to Marnes's empty chair, and Juliet realized the cafeteria staff had probably been as close to the deputy as anyone. Pam left without a word, and Juliet ate with what little appetite she could manage. She eventually thought of one more search she could try on Holston's data, a global spell check to look for names that might offer clues, and eventually figured out how to run it. Meanwhile, her soup grew cold. While her computer began to churn through the hills of data, she took her bowl and a few folders and left her office to sit at one of the cafeteria tables near the wall screen. She was looking for stars on her own when Lucas appeared silently at her side. He didn't say anything, just pulled up a chair, sat down with his board and paper, and peered up at the expansive view of the darkened outside. Juliet couldn't tell if he was being polite to honor her silence, or if he was being rude not to say hello. She finally settled on the former, and eventually the quiet felt normal, shared, a peace at the end of a horrible day. Several minutes passed, 12. There were no stars, and nothing was said. Juliet held a folder in her lap, just to give her fingers something to do. There was a sound from the stairwell, a laughing group moving between the apartment levels below, and then a return to the quiet.
"I'm sorry about your partner," Lucas finally said.
His hands smoothed the paper on the board. He had yet to make a single mark or note.
"I appreciate that," Juliet said.
She wasn't sure what the appropriate response was, but this seemed the least wrong.
"I've been looking for stars, but I haven't seen any," she said.
"You won't, not tonight." He waved his hand at the wall screen. "These are the worst kinds of clouds."
Juliet studied them, barely able to make them out with the last of twilight's distant glow. They looked no different to her than any others. Lucas turned, almost imperceptibly, in his seat.
I have a confession, since you're the law and all. Juliet's hand groped for the star on her chest. She was often in danger of forgetting what she was.
I knew the clouds were going to be bad tonight, but I came up anyway.
Juliet trusted the darkness to conceal her smile. I'm not sure the pact has much to say on such duplicity, she told him.
Lucas laughed.
It was strange how familiar it already sounded, and how badly she needed to hear it. Juliet had a sudden urge to grab him, to tuck her chin into his neck, and to cry. She could almost feel her body begin to piece the moves together, even though her skin would not budge.
It could never happen. She knew this, even as the sensation vibrated within her. It was just the loneliness, the horror of holding Marnes in her arms, of feeling that lifeless heft of a body relieved of whatever animates it. She was desperate for contact, and this stranger was the only person she knew little enough to want it from.
"What happens now?" he asked, his laughter fading.
Juliet almost blurted out inanely,
"Between us?"
But Lucas saved her.
"Do you know when the funeral will be, and where?" he asked.
She stood in the darkness.
"Tomorrow. There is no family to travel up, no investigation to make."
Juliet choked back the tears.
He didn't leave a will, so they left it up to me to make the arrangements. I decided to lay him to rest near the mayor."
Lucas looked up at the wall screen. It was dark enough that the bodies of the cleaners couldn't be seen. A welcome relief.
"As he should be," he said.
"I think they were lovers in secret," Juliet blurted out. "If not lovers, then just as close."
"There's been talk,"
he agreed.
"What I don't get is why I keep it a secret. Nobody would have cared."
Somehow, sitting in the darkness with a complete stranger, these things were more easily aired than in the down deep among friends. Maybe they would have minded people knowing, she thought out loud. Jean's was married before. I suspect they chose to respect that.
"Yeah?"
Lucas scratched something on his paper. Juliet looked up, but was sure there hadn't been a star.
"I can't imagine loving in secret like that," he said.
"I can't imagine needing someone's permission, like the pact, or a girl's father, to be in love in the first place," she replied.
"No? How else would it work? Just any two people, anytime they liked?"
She didn't say.
"How would anyone ever enter the lottery?"
he asked, persisting in the line of thought.
"I can't imagine it not being out in the open. It's a celebration, don't you think?"
"Well, aren't you with anyone?" Juliet asked, cutting him off. "I mean, I'm just asking because it sounds like you have strong opinions, but maybe haven't..."
"Not yet,"
he said, rescuing her again.
"I have a little strength left yet for enduring my mom's guilt. She likes to remind me every year how many lotteries I missed out on and what this did to her overall chances for a bevy of grandchildren. As if I don't know my statistics, but hey, I'm only 25.
"That's all?" Juliet said.
"What about you?"
She nearly told him straight away, nearly blurted out her secret with almost no prompting, as if this man, this boy, a stranger to her, could be trusted.
Never found the right one," she lied.
Lucas laughed his youthful laugh.
"No, I mean, how old are you? Or is that impolite?"
She felt a wave of relief. She thought he'd been asking her about being with anyone.
36, she said. "And I'm told it is impolite to ask, but I've never been one for rules."
"Says our sheriff," Lucas said, laughing at his own joke.
Juliet smiled. "I guess I'm still getting used to that." She turned back to the wall screen, and they both enjoyed the silence that formed. It was strange, sitting with this man. She felt younger and somehow more secure in his presence. Less lonely, at least.
She pegged him as a loner as well,
an odd-sized washer that didn't fit any standard bolt. And here he had been, at the extreme other end of the silo, searching for stars, while she'd been spending what spare time she could down in the mines, as far away as possible, hunting for pretty rocks. "It's not going to be a very productive night for either of us, looks like," she eventually said, ending the silence, rubbing the unopened folder in her lap.
"Oh, I don't know," Lucas told her. "That depends on what you came up here for."
Juliet smiled, and across the wide room, barely audible, the computer on her desk beeped, a search routine having finally pawed through Holston's data before spitting out its results. 6. The next morning, instead of climbing to her office, Juliet descended 5 flights to the upper dirt farm for Marnes's funeral. There would be no folder for her deputy, no investigation, just the lowering of his old and tired body into the deep soil where it would decompose and feed the roots. It was a strange thought, to stand in that crowd and think of him as a folder or not. Less than a week on the job, and she already saw the Manila jackets as places where ghosts reside. Names and case numbers. Lives distilled onto 20 or so sheets of recycled pulp paper. Bits of string and darts of random color woven beneath the black ink that jotted their sad tale. The ceremony was long, but didn't feel so. The earth nearby was still mounded where Jean's had been buried. Soon, the two of them would intermingle inside the plants, and these plants would nourish the occupants of the silo. Juliet accepted a ripe tomato as the priest and his shadow cycled among the thick crowd. The two of them, draped in red fabric, chanted as they went, their voices sonorous and complimenting one another. Juliet bit into her fruit, allowing a polite amount of juice to spatter her coveralls, chewed and swallowed. She could tell the tomato was delicious, but only in a mechanical way. It was hard to truly enjoy it. When it became time for the soil to be shoveled back into the hole, Juliet watched the crowd. 2 people dead from the up top in less than a week. There had been 4 deaths total in that time. A very bad week for the silo. Or good, depending on who you were. She noticed childless couples biting vigorously into their fruit, their hands intertwined, silently doing the math. Lotteries followed too closely after deaths for Juliet's taste. She always thought they should fall on the same dates of the year, just to look as though they were going to happen anyway, whether anyone died or not. But then, the lowering of the body and the plucking of ripe fruit just above the graves was meant to hammer this home. The cycle of life is here. It is inescapable. It is to be embraced, cherished, appreciated. One departs and leaves behind the gift of sustenance, of life. They make room for the next generation. We are born. We are shadows. We cast shadows of our own, and then we are gone. All anyone can hope for is to be remembered, 2 shadows deep. Before the hole was completely filled, members of the feast stepped up to the edge of the farm soil and tossed what remained of their fruit into the hole. Juliet stepped forward and added the rest of her tomato to the colorful hail of rind and pulp. An acolyte leaned on his 2 large shovel and watched the last of the fruit fly. Those that missed, he knocked in with scoops of dark, rich soil, leaving a mound that would, in time and with a few waterings, settle. After the funeral, Juliet began the climb back to her office. She could feel the flights of stairs in her legs, even though she prided herself as being in shape. But walking and climbing were different sorts of exercise. It wasn't turning wrenches or loosening stubborn bolts, and the endurance was of a different kind than merely staying up and alert for an extra shift. She decided it was unnatural, this climbing. Humans weren't meant for it. She doubted they were engineered to travel much beyond a single level of a silo. But then another porter flew down the steps past her, a smile of quick greeting on his non-winded face, his feet dancing across steel treads, and she wondered if perhaps it was something that just took practice. When she finally made it back to the cafeteria, it was lunchtime, and the room was buzzing with noisy chatter and the clinking of metal forks on metal plates. The pile of folded notes outside her office door had grown. There was a plant in a plastic bucket, a pair of shoes, a small sculpture made of colorful wire. Juliet paused over the collection. Without any family, she supposed it would be up to her to go through it all, to make sure the items went to those who would use them best. She bent down and picked up one of the cards. The writing was in unsure print, scrawled with crayon. She imagined the upper grade school had spent craft time that day making cards for Deputy Marnes. This saddened Juliet more than any of the ceremonies. She wiped tears out of her eyes and damned the teachers who thought to get the kids involved in the nastiness of it all.
"Leave them out of it," she whispered to herself.
She replaced the card and composed herself. Deputy Marnes would have liked to have seen this, she decided. He was an easy man to figure, one of those who had grown old everywhere but in his heart, that one organ he had never worn out because he'd never dared to use it. Inside her office, she was surprised to find she had company. A stranger sat at Deputy Marnes's desk. He looked up from the computer and smiled at her. She was about to ask who he was when Bernard—she refused to think of him as even interim mayor—stepped out of the holding cell, a folder in hand, smiling at Juliet.
"How are the services?"
he asked. Juliet crossed the office and snatched the folder out of his hand. "Please don't tamper with anything," she said.
"Tamper?" Bernard laughed and adjusted his glasses. "That's a closed case. I was going to take it back to my offices and refile it."
Juliet checked the folder and saw that it was Holston's.
"You do know that you report to me, right? You were supposed to have at least glanced over the pact before Jean swore you in."
"I'll hold on to this, thanks."
Juliet left him by the open cell and went back to her desk. She shoved the folder in the top drawer, checked that the data drive was still jutting out from her computer, and looked up at the guy across from her.
"And you are?"
He stood, and Deputy Marnes's chair let out its customary squeak. Juliet tried to force herself not to think of it as his anymore.
"Peter Billings, ma'am."
He held out his hand. Juliet accepted it.
"I was just sworn in myself."
He pinched the corner of his star and held it away from his coveralls for her to see.
"Peter here was actually up for your job," Bernard said.
Juliet wondered what he meant by that, or what the point was to even mention it.
"Did you need something?" she asked Bernard.
She waved at her desk, which had piled up the day before as she had spent most of her time managing Marnes's affairs.
"Because anything you need doing, I can add it to the bottom of one of these piles here."
"Anything I give you goes on top," Bernard said.
He slapped his hand down on the folder with Jean's name on it.
"And I'm doing you a favor by coming up and having this meeting here rather than having you come down to my office."
What meeting is this?"
Juliet asked. She didn't look up, but busied herself sorting papers. Hopefully he would see how busy she was and leave, and she could start getting Peter up to speed on what little she herself had figured out.
"As you know, there's been quite a bit of turnover these past weeks. Unprecedented, really, at least since the uprising. And that's the danger, I'm afraid, if we aren't all on the same page."
He pressed his finger into the folder Juliet was trying to move, pinning it in place. She glanced up at him.
"People want continuity. They want to know tomorrow will be a lot like yesterday. They want reassurances. Now, we've just had a cleaning, and we've suffered some losses, so the mood is naturally a bit raucous."
He waved at the folders and piles of pulp paper spilling from Juliet's desk to Peter's.
The young man across from her seemed to eye the mound warily, like more of the pile could shift toward him, giving him more of it to do.
Which is why I am going to announce a forgiveness moratorium. Not only to strengthen the spirits of the entire silo, but to help you two clear the slate so you don't get overwhelmed while you're getting up to speed on your duties.
Clear the slate? Juliet asked.
That's right. All these drunken misdemeanors. What's this one for?
He picked up a folder and studied the name on the label.
Oh, now, what's Pickens done this time?
He ate a neighbor's rat, Juliet said. Family pet. Peter Billings chuckled. Juliet squinted at him, wondering why his name sounded familiar. Then she placed it, recalling a memo he had written in one of the folders. This kid, practically a boy, had been shadowing a silo judge, she thought. She had a difficult time imagining that, looking at him. He seemed more the IT type.
I thought owning rats as pets was illegal, Bernard said.
It is. He's the claimant. It's a countersuit in retaliation, she sorted through the folders, for this one right here.
Let's see, Bernard said.
He grabbed the other folder, held the two of them together, and then dropped them both into her recycle bin, all the carefully organized papers and notes spilling out and intermingling in a jumbled pile on top of other scraps of paper to be repulped.
Forgive and forget, he said, wiping his palms together. That's going to be my election motto. The people need this. This is about new beginnings. Forgetting the past during these tumultuous times, looking to the future.
He slapped her on the back, hard, nodded to Peter, and headed for the door. Election motto? She asked before he could get away. And it occurred to her that one of the folders he was suggesting could be forgiven was the one wherein he was the prime suspect.
Oh, yes, Bernard called over his shoulder.
He grabbed the jam and looked back at her.
I've decided, after much deliberation, that there is no one better qualified for this job than me. I don't see any problem with continuing my duties in IT while performing the role as mayor. In fact, I already am, he winked. Continuity, you know.
And then he was gone. Juliet spent the rest of the afternoon well past what Peter Billings considered sensible working hours, getting him up to speed. What she needed most of all was someone to field complaints and to respond to the radio. This was Holston's old job, ranging the top 48 and calling on any disturbance. Deputy Marnes had hoped to see Juliet fill that role with her younger, fresher legs. He had also said that a pretty female might do the public will some good. Juliet had other ideas about his intentions. She suspected Marnes had wanted her away so he could spend time alone with his folder and its ghost. And she well understood that urge. So as she sent Peter Billings home with a list of apartments and merchants to call on the next day, she finally had time to sit down to her computer and see the results from the previous night's search. The spell checker had turned up interesting results. Not so much the names she had hoped for, but rather these large blocks of what looked like coded text. Gibberish with strange punctuation, indentation, and embedded words she recognized but that seemed out of place. These massive paragraphs were spread throughout Holston's home computer, first showing up just over 3 years ago. That made it fit the timeline. But what really caught Juliet's eye was how often the data appeared in nested directories, sometimes a dozen or more folders deep. It was as if someone had taken pains to keep them hidden, but had wanted multiple copies stashed away, terrified of losing them. She assumed it was encoded, whatever it was, and important. She tore off bites of a small loaf of bread and dipped these in cornspread while she gathered a full copy of this gibberish to send down to Mechanical. There were a few guys perhaps smart enough to make some sense of the code, starting with Walker. She chewed her food and spent the next hours going back over the trail she had managed to tease out of Holston's final years on the job. It had been difficult to narrow his activities down, to figure out what was important and what was noise, but she had approached it as logically as any other breakdown. because that's what she was dealing with, she decided. A breakdown. Gradual and interminable. Almost inevitable. Losing his wife had been like a seal or a gasket cracking. Everything that had rattled out of control for Holston could be traced back, almost mechanically, to that. One of the first things she'd realized was that his activity on the work computer held no secrets. Holston had obviously become a night rat, just like her, staying up for hours in his apartment. It was yet another commonality she felt between them, further strengthening her obsession with the man. Sticking to his home computer meant she could ignore over half the data. It also became apparent that he had spent most of his time investigating his wife, just as Juliet was now prying into him. This was their deepest shared bond, Juliet's and Holston's. Here she was, looking into the last voluntary cleaner as he had looked into his wife, hoping to discover what torturous cause might lead a person to choose the forbidden outside. And it was here that Juliet began to find clues, almost eerie in their connection. Allison, Holston's wife, seemed to be the one who had unlocked the mysteries of the old servers. The very method that had made Holston's data available to Juliet had at some point brought some secret to Allison, and then to Holston. By focusing on deleted emails between the couple, and noting the explosion of communication around the time she had published a document detailing some undeletion method, Juliet stumbled onto what she felt was a valid trail. She became more certain that Allison had found something on the servers. The trouble was determining what it was, and whether she'd recognize it herself even if she found it. She toyed with several ideas, even the chance that Allison had been driven to rage by infidelity, but Juliet had enough of a feel for Holston to know that this wasn't the case. And then she noticed each trail of activity seemed to lead back to the paragraphs of gibberish, an answer Juliet kept looking for any excuse to reject because she couldn't make any sense of it. Why would Holston, and Allison especially, spend so much time looking at all that nonsense? The activity log showed her keeping them open for hours at a time, as if the scrambled letters and symbols could be read. To Juliet, it looked like a wholly new language. So what was it that sent Holston and his wife to cleaning? The common assumption around the silo was that Allison had gotten the stirs, had gone crazy for the out-of-doors, and that Holston eventually succumbed to his grief. But Juliet never bought that. She didn't like coincidences. When she tore a machine down to repair it, and a new problem surfaced a few days later, all she usually had to do was go back through the steps from the last repair. The answer was always there. She saw this riddle the same way. It was a much simpler diagnosis if both of them were driven out by the same thing. She just couldn't see what it might be, and part of her feared that finding it could drive her crazy as well. Juliet rubbed her eyes. When she looked at her desk again, Jean's folder caught her attention. On top of her folder sat the doctor's report for Marnes. She moved the report aside and reached for the note underneath, the one Marnes had written and left on his small bedside table. It should have been me. So few words, Juliet thought. But then, who remained in the silo for him to speak to? She studied the handful of words, but there was little to squeeze from them. It was his canteen that had been poisoned, not Jean's. It actually made her death a case of manslaughter, a new term for Juliet. Marnes had explained something else about the law. The worst offense they could hope to pin on anyone was the attempted and unsuccessful murder on him, rather than the botched accident that had claimed the mayor. Which meant, if they could nail the act on a guilty party, that person could be put to cleaning for what they had failed to accomplish with Marnes, while only getting 5 years probation and silo service for what had accidentally happened to Jean's. Juliet thought it was this crooked sense of fairness as much as anything else that had worn down poor Marnes. There was never any hope for true justice, a life for a life. These strange laws, coupled with the agonizing knowledge that he had carried the poison on his own body, had gravely wounded him. He had to live with being the poison's porter, with the hurtful knowledge that a good deed, a shared walk, had been his love's death. Juliet held the suicide note and cursed herself for not seeing it coming. It should have been a foreseeable breakdown, a problem solved by a little preventative maintenance. She could have said more, reached out somehow, but she had been too busy trying to stay afloat those first few days to see that the man who had brought her up to the uptop was slowly unraveling right before her eyes. The flash of her inbox icon interrupted these disturbing thoughts. She reached for the mouse and cursed herself. The large chunk of data she had sent down to mechanical some hours earlier must have been rejected. Maybe it was too much to send at once. But then she saw that it was a message from Scotty, her friend in IT who had supplied the data drive. "Come now," it read. It was an odd request, vague and yet dire, especially for the late hour. Juliet powered down her monitor, grabbed the drive from the computer in case she had more visitors, and briefly considered strapping Marnes's ancient gun around her waist. She stood, went to the key locker, and ran her hand down the soft belt, feeling the indention where the buckle had, for decades, worn into the same spot on the old leather. She thought again of Marnes's terse note and looked to his empty chair. She decided in the end to leave the gun hanging where it was. She nodded to his desk, made sure she had her keys, and hurried out the door. 7. It was 34 levels down to IT. Juliet skipped across the steps so swiftly she had to keep a hand on the inner railing to keep from flying outward into the occasional upbound traffic. She overtook a porter near 6 who was startled from being passed. By the 10th floor, she was beginning to feel dizzy from the round and round. She wondered how Holston and Marnes had ever responded to trouble with any degree of urgency. The other two deputy stations, the one in the mids and the one in the down deep, were nicely situated near the dead center of their 48 floors, a far superior arrangement. She passed into the 20s thinking about this, that her office was not ideally positioned to respond to the far edge of her precinct. Instead, it had been located by the airlock and the holding cell, close to the highest form of the silo's capital punishment. Her legs cursed this decision as she considered the long slog back up. In the high 20s, she practically bowled a man over who wasn't watching where he was going. She wrapped one arm around him and gripped the railing, keeping them both from a nasty tumble. He apologized while she swallowed a curse. And then she saw it was Lucas, his lapboard strapped to his back, nubs of charcoal sticking out of his coveralls. "Oh," he said. "Hello." He smiled at seeing her, but his lips drooped into a frown when he realized she'd been hurrying the opposite direction. "I'm sorry," she said. I've got to go."
"Of course."
He stood out of the way, and Juliet finally took her hands off his ribs. She nodded, not sure what to say, her thoughts only on Scotty, and then she continued her run down, moving too fast to chance a glance back. When she finally got to 34, she paused on the landing to catch her breath and let the dizziness fade. Checking her coveralls, that her star was in place and the flash drive still in her pocket, she pulled open the main doors to IT and tried to stroll in as if she belonged there. She sized up the entrance room quickly. To her right, a glass window looked into a conference room. The light was on, even though it was now the middle of the night. A handful of heads were visible through the glass, a meeting taking place. She thought she heard Bernard's voice, loud and nasally, leeching through the door. Ahead of her stood the low security gates leading back to IT's labyrinth of apartments, offices, and workshops. Juliet could imagine the floor plan. She'd heard that the three levels shared much in common with mechanical, only without the fun.
"Can I help you?"
a young man in silver coveralls asked from behind the gates. She approached. "Sheriff Nichols," she said. She waved her ID at him, then passed it under the gate's laser scanner. The light turned red, and the gate let out an angry buzz. It did not open. "I'm here to see Scotty, one of your techs." She tried the card again with the same result.
"Do you have an appointment?" the man asked.
Juliet narrowed her eyes at the man. "I'm the sheriff. Since when do I need appointments?" Again with the card, and again the gate buzzed at her. The young man did not move to help.
"Please do not do that," he said.
"Look, son, I'm in the middle of an investigation here, and you're impeding my progress." He smiled at her.
"I'm sure you're familiar with the unique position we maintain here, and that your powers are..."
Juliet put her ID away and reached over the gate to grab the straps of his coveralls with both hands. She pulled him almost clear over the gates, her arms bulging with the sinewy muscles that had freed countless bolts. "Listen here, you blasted runt. I am coming through these gates, or I'm coming over them, and then through you. I'll have you know that I report directly to Bernard Holland, acting mayor, and your goddamn boss. Do I make myself clear?" The kid's eyes were wide and all pupil. He jerked his chin up and down. "Then move it," she said, letting go of his coveralls with a shove. He fumbled for his ID, swiped it through the scanner. Juliet pushed through the spinning arms of the turnstile and passed him, then stopped.
Which way, exactly?"
The boy was still trying to get his ID back on his chest pocket, his hand trembling.
That-away, ma'am."
He pointed to the right.
"Second hall, take a left, last office."
"Good man," she said. She turned and smiled to herself. It seemed that the same tone that got bickering mechanics to snap to back home worked here as well. And she laughed to herself to think of the argument she had used. "Your boss is also my boss, so open up." But then, with eyes that wide and that much fear in his veins, she could have read him Mama Jean's bread recipe with the same tone and gotten through the gates. This was a skill to remember. She took the second hallway, passing by a man and woman in IT silver as they both walked the other way. They turned to watch her pass. At the end of the hall, she found offices on both sides and didn't know which one was Scotty's. She peeked first into the one with the open door, but the lights were off. She turned to the other one and knocked. There was no answer at first, but the light at the bottom of the door dimmed, as if someone had walked across it.
"Who's there?"
a familiar voice whispered through the door.
"Open this damn thing," Juliet said. "You know who this is."
The lever dipped, the door clicking open. Juliet pushed her way inside, and Scotty shoved the door closed behind her, engaging the lock.
"Were you seen?"
he asked. She looked at him incredulously. "Was I seen? Of course I was seen. How do you think I got in? There are people everywhere."
"But did they see you come in here?"
he whispered.
"Scotty, what the hell is going on?"
Juliet was beginning to suspect she had hurried all this way for nothing.
"You sent me a wire, which already seemed desperate enough, but you told me to come now, so here I am."
"Where did you get this stuff?"
he asked. Scotty grabbed a spool of printout from his desk and held it in trembling hands. Juliet stepped beside him. She placed a hand on his arm and looked at the paper.
"Just calm down," she said quietly.
She tried to read a few lines and immediately recognized the gibberish she had sent to Mechanical earlier that day.
"How did you get this?" she asked. "I just wired this to Knox a few hours ago."
Scotty nodded.
"And he wired it to me, but he shouldn't have. I can get into a lot of trouble for this."
Juliet laughed. "You're kidding, right?" She saw that he wasn't.
"Scotty, you're the one who pulled all this stuff for me in the first place."
She stepped back and looked hard at him.
"Wait, you know what this nonsense is, right? You can read it."
He bobbed his head.
"Jules, I didn't know what I was grabbing for you at the time. It was gigs of crap. I didn't look at it. I just grabbed it and passed it on."
"Why is this so dangerous?" she asked.
"I can't even talk about it," Scotty said. "I'm not cleaning material, Jules. I'm not."
He held out the scroll.
"Here, I shouldn't have even printed it. But I wanted to delete the wire. You've got to take it. Get it out of here. I can't be caught with it."
Juliet took the scroll, but just to calm him down.
"Scotty, sit down. Please. Look, I know you're scared, but I need you to sit and talk to me about this. It is very important."
He shook his head.
"Scotty, sit the hell down right now!"
She pointed at the chair, and Scotty numbly obeyed. Juliet sat on the corner of his desk and noted that the cot at the back of the room had recently been slept on, and felt pity for the young man. "Whatever this is," she shook the roll of paper, "it's what caused the last two cleanings." She told him this like it was more than a rapidly forming theory, like it was something she knew. Maybe it was the fear in his eyes that cemented the idea, or the need to act strong and sure to help calm him down. "Scotty, I need to know what it is. Look at me." He did. "Do you see this star?" She flicked it with her finger, causing a dull ring. He nodded. "I'm not your shift foreman anymore, lad. I'm the law, and this is very important. Now, I don't know if you're aware of this, but you can't get into any trouble for answering my questions. In fact, you're obligated to answer them." He looked up at her with a twinge of hope. He obviously didn't know that she was making this up. Not lying. She would never turn Scotty in for all the silo, but she was pretty sure there was no such thing as immunity, not for anyone. "What am I holding?" she asked, waving the scroll of printout.
It's a program," he whispered.
"You mean like a timing circuit? Like a..."
No, for a computer. A programming language. It's a..."
He looked away.
"I don't want to say. Oh, Jules, I just want to go back to mechanical. I want none of this to have happened."
Those words were like a splash of cold water. Scotty was more than frightened. He was terrified. For his life. Juliet got off the desk and crouched beside him, placed her hand on the back of his hand, which rested on his anxiously bouncing knee. "What does the program do?" she asked. He bit his lip and shook his head.
"It's okay. We're safe here. Tell me what it does." "It's for a display," he finally said. "But not for like a readout or an LED or a dot matrix. There are algorithms in here I recognize. Anyone would..."
He paused.
64-bit color,"
he whispered, staring at her.
64-bit. Why would anyone need that much color?"
"Dumb it down for me," Juliet said. Scotty seemed on the verge of going mad.
"You've seen it, right? The view up top?"
She dipped her head. "You know where I work."
"Well, I've seen it too. Back before I started eating every meal in here, working my fingers to the bone."
He rubbed his hands up through his shaggy, sandy brown hair.
"This program, Jules, what you've got, it could make something like that wall screen look real."
Juliet digested this, then laughed. "But wait, isn't that what it does? Scotty, there are sensors out there. They just take the images they see, and then the screen has to display the view, right? I mean, you've got me confused here." She shook the printed scroll of gibberish. "Doesn't this just do what I think it does, put the image on the display?" Scotty wrung his hands together.
"You wouldn't need anything like this. You're talking about passing an image through. I could write a dozen lines of code that do that. No, this is about making images. It's more complex."
He grabbed Juliet's arm.
"Jules, this thing can make brand new views. It can show you anything you like."
He sucked in his breath, and a slice of time hung in the air between them, a pause where hearts did not beat and eyes did not blink. Juliet sat back on her haunches, balancing on the toes of her old boots. She finally settled her butt to the floor and leaned back against the metal paneling of his office wall.
"So now, you see,"
Scotty started to say, but Juliet held up her hand, hushing him. It never occurred to her that the view could be fabricated. But why not? And what would be the point? She imagined Holston's wife discovering this. She must have been at least as smart as Scotty. She was the one who came up with the technique he had used to find this in the first place, right? What would she have done with this discovery? Say something out loud and cause a riot? Tell her husband, the sheriff, what? Juliet could only know what she herself would do in that position, if she were almost convinced. She was, by nature, too curious a person to doubt what she might do. It would gnaw at her, like the rattling innards of a sealed machine, or the secret workings of an unopened device.
she would have to grab a screwdriver and a wrench and have a peek.
Jules!
She waved him off. Details from Holston's folder flooded back. Notes about Allison, how she suddenly went crazy almost out of nowhere. Her curiosity must have driven her there. Unless Holston didn't know. Unless it was all an act. Unless Allison had been shielding her husband from some horror with a mock veil of insanity. But would it have taken Holston 3 years to piece together what she had figured out in a week? Or did he already know, and it just took 3 years to summon the courage to go after her? Or did Juliet have an advantage he hadn't? She had Scotty, and she was, after all, following the breadcrumbs of someone else following more breadcrumbs, a much easier and more obvious trail. She looked up at her young friend, who was peering worriedly down at her.
"You have to get those out of here,"
he said, glancing at the printouts. Juliet nodded. She pushed up from the floor and tucked the scroll into the breast of her coveralls. It would have to be destroyed. She just wasn't sure how.
"I deleted my copies of everything I got for you," he said. "I am done looking at them, and you should do the same."
Juliet tapped her chest pocket, felt the hard bulge of the flash drive there.
"And Jules, can you do me a favor?"
"Anything."
"See if there's any way I can transfer back to mechanical, will you? I don't want to be up here anymore."
She nodded and squeezed his shoulder. "I'll see what I can do," she promised, feeling a knot in her gut for getting the poor kid involved at all. 8. Juliet arrived late at her desk the next morning, exhausted, her legs and back sore from the late climb down to IT and from not getting an ounce of sleep. She had spent the entire night tossing and turning, wondering if she'd discovered a box that was better left unopened, worried she might be raising questions that promised nothing but bad answers. If she went out into the cafeteria and looked in a direction she normally avoided, she would be able to see the last two cleaners lying in the crook of a hill, almost as if in one another's arms. Did those two lovers throw themselves into the rotting wind over the very thing Juliet was now chasing? The fear that she'd seen in Scotty's eyes made her wonder if she wasn't being careful enough. She looked across her desk at her new deputy, greener even at this job than she, as he transcribed data from one of the folders. "Hey, Peter?" He looked up from his keyboard.
"Yeah?"
"You were in justice before this, right? Shadowing with a judge?" He tilted his head to the side.
"No, I was a court assistant. I actually shadowed in the Mid's deputy office until a few years ago. I wanted that job, but none came up."
"Did you grow up there, or the up top?"
"The Mid's."
His hands fell away from his keyboard to his lap. He smiled.
"My dad was a plumber in the hydroponics. He passed away a few years ago. My mom, she works in the nursery."
"Really? What's her name?"
"Rebecca? She's one of the..."
"Oh, I know her. She was shadowing when I was a kid. My father..."
"He works in the upper nursery. I know. I didn't want to say anything."
"Why not? Hey, if you're worried about me playing favorites, I'm guilty. You're my deputy now, and I'll have your back."
"No, it's not just that. I just didn't want you to hold anything against me. I know you and your father don't..."
Juliet waved him off. "He's still my father. We just grew apart. Tell your mom I said hi."
"I will."
Peter smiled and bent over his keyboard. "Hey, I've got a question for you, something I can't figure."
"Sure," he said, looking up. "Go ahead."
"Can you think of why it's cheaper to porter a paper note to someone than it is to just wire them from a computer?"
"Oh, sure," he nodded. "It's a quarter chip per character to wire someone. That adds up."
Juliet laughed. "No, I know what it costs. But paper isn't cheap either, and neither is porting. But it seems like sending a wire would be practically free, you know? It's just information. It weighs nothing."
He shrugged. "It's been a quarter chit a character since I've been alive. I don't know. Besides, we've got a 50 chit per day allowance from here, plus unlimited emergencies. I wouldn't stress."
I'm not stressed, just confused. I mean, I understand why everyone can't have radios like we carry, because only one person can transmit at a time, so we need the air open for emergencies, but you'd think we could all send and receive as many wires as we wanted. Peter propped his elbows up and rested his chin on his fists.
Well, think about the cost of the servers, the electricity. That means oil to burn and all the maintenance of the wires and cooling and whatnot, especially if you have a ton of traffic. Factor that against pressing pulp on a rack, letting it dry, scratching some ink on it, and then having a person who's already headed that way walk it up or down for you. No wonder it's cheaper.
Juliet nodded, but mostly for his benefit. She wasn't so sure. She hated to voice why, but she couldn't help herself. But what if it's for a different reason? What if someone made it expensive on purpose?
What, to make money? Peter snapped his fingers. To keep the porters employed with running notes.
Juliet shook her head. No. What if it's to make conversing with each other more difficult? Or at least costly, you know. Separate us. Make us keep our thoughts to ourselves.
Peter frowned. Why would anyone want to do that?
Shrugging, Juliet looked back at her computer screen, her hand creeping to the scroll hidden in her lap. I don't know, she said. Forget about it. It's just a silly thought. She pulled her keyboard toward her and was just glancing up at her screen when Peter saw the emergency icon first.
Wow, another alert, he said.
She started to click on the flashing icon, heard Peter blow out his breath.
What the hell is going on around here?
She pulled the message up on her screen and read it quickly, disbelieving. Surely this wasn't the way of the job. Surely people didn't die this often. Her just not hearing about it because her nose was always in some crankcase or under an oil pan. The blinking number code above the message was one she recognized without even needing her cheat sheet. It became sadly familiar. Another suicide. They didn't give the victim's name, but there was an office number. And she knew the floor and address. Her legs were still sore from her trip down there. No, she said, gripping the edge of her desk.
You want me to...
Peter reached for his radio. No, damn it, no! Juliet shook her head. She pushed away from her desk, knocking over the recycling bin, which spilled out all the pardon folders across the floor. The scroll from her lap rolled into them.
I can... Peter began.
I got this, she said, waving him away. Damn it! She shook her head. The office was spinning around her head, the world getting blurry. She staggered for the door, arms wide for balance, when Peter snapped back to his computer screen, dragging his mouse with its little cord behind, clicking something.
Juliet?
But she was already stumbling out the door, bracing herself for the long and painful descent.
Juliet!
She turned to find Peter running behind her, his hand steadying the radio attached to his hip. What? She asked.
I'm sorry, it's... I don't know how to do this.
Spit it out! She said impatiently. All she could think of was little Scotty, hanging by his neck. It was electrical ties in her imagination. That's how her waking nightmare, her morbid thoughts, crafted the scene of his death in her head.
It's just that... I got a private wire and...
Keep up if you want, but I've got to get down there. She spun toward the stairwell. Peter grabbed her arm, roughly, a forceful grip.
I'm sorry, ma'am, but I'm supposed to take you into custody.
She whirled on him and saw how unsure of himself he looked. What did you say?
I'm just doing my duty, Sheriff, I swear.
Peter reached for his metal cuffs. Juliet stared at him, disbelieving, as he snapped one link around her wrist and fumbled for the other. Peter, what's going on? I've got a friend I need to see to... He shook his head.
The computer says you're a suspect, ma'am. I'm just doing what it tells me to do.
And with that, the second link clicked around her other wrist, and Juliet looked down at her predicament, dumbfounded, the image of her young friend hanging by his neck, unable to be shaken loose from her mind. 9. She was allowed a visitor, but who would Juliet want to see her like this? No one. So she sat with her back against the bars,
the bleak view outside brightening with the rising of an unseen sun, the floor around her bare of folders and ghosts. She was alone, stripped of a job she wasn't sure she ever wanted, a pile of bodies in her wake, her simple and easily understood life having come unraveled.
"I'm sure this will pass," a voice behind her said.
Juliet leaned away from the steel rods and looked around to find Bernard standing behind her, his hands wrapped around the bars. Juliet moved away from him and sat on the cot, turning her back to the gray view. "You know I didn't do this," she said. "He was my friend." Bernard frowned.
"What do you think you're being held for? The boy committed suicide. He seems to have been distraught from recent tragedies. This is not unheard of when people move to a new section of the silo, away from friends and family, to take a job they're not entirely suited for."
"Then why am I being held here?" Juliet asked. She realized suddenly that there may be no double cleaning after all. Off to the side, down the hallway, she could see Peter shuffling back and forth like some physical barrier prevented him from coming any closer.
"Unauthorized entry on the 34th, Bernard said. "Threatening a member of the silo, tampering with IT affairs, removing IT property from secured quarters."
"That's rat shit," Juliet said. "I was summoned by one of your workers. I had every right to be there."
"We will look into that," Bernard said. "Well, Peter, here it will. I'm afraid he's had to remove your computer for evidence. My people down below are best qualified to see if..."
"Your people? Are you trying to be the mayor or IT head? Because I looked into it, and the pact clearly states you can't be both."
"That will be put to vote soon enough. The pact has changed before. It's designed to change when events call for it."
"And so you want me out of the way?" Juliet stepped closer to the bar so she could see Peter Billings and have him see her.
"I suppose you were here to have this job all along. Is that right?"
Peter slunk out of sight.
"Juliet. Jules."
Bernard shook his head and clicked his tongue at her.
"I don't want you out of the way. I wouldn't want that for any member of the silo. I want people to be in their place. Where they fit in. Scotty wasn't cut out for IT, I see that now. And I don't think you were meant for the up-top."
"So what, I'm banished back to mechanical? Is that what's going on? Over some rat-shit charges?"
"Banished is such a horrible word. I'm sure you didn't mean that. And don't you want your old job back? Weren't you happier then? There's so much to learn up here that you've never shadowed for. And the people who thought you best fit for this job, who I'm sure hoped to ease you into it..."
He stopped right there, and it was somehow worse that he left the sentence open like that, forcing Jules to complete the image rather than just hear it. She pictured two mounds of freshly turned soil in the gardens, a few morning rinds tossed on top of them.
"I'm going to let you gather your things, what isn't needed for evidence, and then allow you to see yourself back down. As long as you check in with my deputies on the way and report your progress, we'll drop these charges. Consider it an extension of my little forgiveness holiday."
Bernard smiled and straightened his glasses. Juliet gritted her teeth. It occurred to her that she had never, in her entire life, punched someone in the face. And it was only her fear of missing, of not doing it correctly and cracking her knuckles on one of the steel bars, that prevented her from putting an end to that streak. It was just about a week since she had arrived at the up-top, and Juliet was leaving with fewer belongings than she'd brought. A blue mechanical coverall had been provided, one much too big for her. Peter didn't even say goodbye. Juliet thought it was more out of shame than anger or blame. He walked her through the cafeteria to the top of the stairs, and as she turned to shake his hand, she found him staring down at his toes, his thumbs caught in his overalls, her sheriff's badge pinned at an angle over his left breast. Juliet began her long walk down through the length of the silo. it would be less physically taxing than her walk up had been, but more draining in other ways. What exactly had happened to the silo, and why? She couldn't help but feel in the middle of it all, to shoulder some of the blame. None of this would have happened had they left her in Mechanical, had they never come to see her in the first place. She would still be bitching about the alignment of the generator, not sleeping at night as she waited for the inevitable failure and a descent into chaos as they learned to survive on backup power for the decades it would take to rebuild the thing. Instead, she had been witness to a different type of failure, a throwing not of rods but of bodies. She felt most horrible for Scotty. A boy with so much promise, so many talents, taken before his prime. She had been sheriff for a short time, a star appearing on her breast for but a wink, and yet she felt an incredible urge to investigate. There was something not right about Scotty killing himself. The signs were there, sure. He had been afraid to leave his office, but then he'd also shadowed under Walker and had maybe picked up the habit of reclusiveness from the old man. Scotty had also been harboring secrets too big for his young mind, had been fearful enough to wire her to come quickly. But she knew the boy like her own shadow, and knew he didn't have it in him. She suddenly wondered if Marnes had ever had it in him as well. If Jean's were here, beside her, would the old mayor be screaming for Jules to investigate both their deaths, telling her that none of this fit? "I can't," Juliet whispered to the ghost, causing an upbound porter to turn his head as he passed. She kept further thoughts to